ESPN Kansas City presents Golf Underground with Kevin Ward and Brian Sullivan.
Welcome to Golf Underground on ESPN Radio. We are honored today to have one of Austin's favorite sons, Tom Kite. Let's do a formal intro. University of Texas All-American, inducted into the World Golf Hall of Fame in 2004. 19 wins on the PGA Tour, 2 European Tour wins, PGA Champions Tour. He's had a heck of a run there in Pebble Beach, 1992 U.S. Open.
And I want to dive into that one later on.
Yeah. So, Mr. Kite, thank you for taking the time.
You
really
bet.
Appreciate
nice
it.
Nice to be with you guys.
Yeah. Yeah.
So dive in. Here we are at the match play. What? This is your home course. Talk a little bit about the golf course and why you love playing here and coming out and practicing.
Well, I think Pete Dye is one of the has been the most innovative architect that we've seen for since the 20s and 30s when you had. McKenzie and Tillinghast and those guys designing all the great golf courses, Donald Ross. But I think Pete's done a terrific job, and he always seems to come up with great designs on golf courses, on pieces of property that are really difficult to build on. This is certainly, when you think about TPC Jacksonville, the Players Club down there, I mean, it's in a swamp. He figured out a way to get rid of all the muck that was on top and bury it under the spectator mounds and dig a bunch of lakes and come up with some good sand material and, created a golf course that is terrific. Here in Austin, you got a little bit of floodplain down in the bottom, even though that's all controlled now with the dams and everything, but you got some great soil down there. But up top, where 13 of the holes are, you're on solid rock, and some pretty severe cross slopes, and Pete came in and cut on one side and filled on the other side, built some beautiful rock retaining walls, and leveled out or created some level spaces to put the golf course on, and so it allowed him to put a golf course on a very difficult piece of property, and of course. In my opinion, Pete designs the most strategic golf courses around, and there's multiple ways to play almost every hole in this golf course, and it makes it a wonderful golf course for our membership as well as for the top players in the game.
Yeah.
Did Pete Dye influence the way you design golf courses?
A lot. When this golf course was under construction, I spent a lot of time out here with Pete, and. I wish I could say that I could do it as good as he does, but he has a tremendous knack for being able to create angles that force you to play a hole or allow you to play a hole multiple ways, depending upon how aggressive you want to get. Everything is created with strategic angles. He rewards you for being aggressive and being able to pull off a shot. He penalizes you for missing a shot, I think that's just wonderful the way he does that golf course.
That's awesome. So dive in. Here we are at the home of Harvey Pienick. Talk a little bit about his teaching of you and you being under his wing, and then obviously you've worked with several great instructors, Chuck Cook, one of which we had on the show last week. Talk a little bit about some of the lessons you learned from Harvey.
Well, when you're a kid growing up, you're really not totally aware that you're working with maybe the greatest teacher that there's ever been, or certainly one of the top two or three or four. You're a 12-year-old kid, 13-year-old kid out there and just trying to learn how to play. And Harvey was, he did everything kind of the right way. He let us learn. He didn't dictate the teaching. He created opportunities and games and suggested practice patterns for us that allowed us to learn how to play the game. And he understood the number one thing in golf was to be able to shoot a good number. And so everything he did was trying to encourage us to become better shot makers and better players. And ultimately that would allow us to shoot lower scores. He was big into games. Mm-hmm. You know, he loved competitive games. He would always create situations to put you under a little bit of pressure. He would have games that would force you to be creative, and you know, that as a kid, that's just stuff that you know, allows you to really grow and become a much better player.
What game would practice game would he? Did you like the most that you used in terms of short game?
Oh, gosh, there were just so many, it wasn't even funny, but, you know.
Towel game was my favorite. He used to kick my butt.
The towel game is pretty good, but, you know, I mean, it's just like, okay, Tommy, I know you're getting ready to go play golf. I'm going to take all the odd number clubs out of your bag. Right? And, you know, you go play the 9 holes or 18 holes with, you know, half your set. Well, of course, you know, all of a sudden you never have, it seems like when you don't have a 7-iron in your bag, it seems like every shot you get is a perfect 7-iron, but you don't have a 7, so now you got to hit a 6 an 8 or, you know, whatever, you've got to be creative there.
What do you think the intention was with that, though? Why do you think he did it? Just to keep it interesting, or he thought it would help you?
No, that's the way you learn. You can't learn to hit an easy 6 if all the time you grab your 7-iron. Mm-hmm. Yeah. You can't learn to hit a hard 8 if every time you grab a 7-iron. You know, so, you know, it just allowed you to learn how to play more shots.
So you're one of the best, if not the best ever. I watched you hit wedges for years. Talk a little bit about the flighting of the wedge and how you were able to make that one of your strengths and kind of your beliefs behind it.
Well, I believe that, you know, when you're hitting wedges, it's all about distance control. It's not about distance, it's distance control. Nobody hits wedges offline. You know, you're always, your dispersion pattern left and right is usually pretty tight. But your dispersion pattern long and short can be significant, especially if you start throwing some chunked wedges or some bladed wedges in there. You can really get some significant differences in your distance, but so being able to control the speed of your swing is paramount. And if you think about it, you've got your body and your arms and your wrist action. Those are your three main components that provide speed. You know, how fast your body moves and rotates, how fast you swing your arms, and how much wrist set. And being able to control that means being able to, you know, effectively limit the speed that you apply to a shot. Mm-hmm. You have to be able to hit the ball hard. You want to be aggressive. Deceleration is death in golf. whether you're trying to hit a 3-inch putt or a 300-yard drive, you got to have that club accelerating. But how do you accelerate a club and only have it go 30 yards? Or how do you accelerate a club and only have it go 50 yards? And to be able to do that repetitively is learning how to you know, limit your body rotation, limit your arm swing, and limit your wrist set. And you know, I've always been a big believer that if you reduce the wrist action, it makes it very easy. And so when I look at the great wedge players right now, the guys that I think are terrific, you know, Steve Stricker and Zach Johnson come to mind, and both those guys on their wedge game, they limit a lot of hand action on the backswing.
So I was watching DJ hit some yesterday, and you know, I just want your opinion on how he's able to go from that boat, or in his opinion, it's square, but how he's able to square that up, or clearly that's through body rotation.
Body rotation, yeah. There's no question. You know, DJ creates a lot of lag, and you look at any good wedge player and they have a lot of lean to their shaft at impact. The handle is always in front of the club head when the club hits the ball. And sometimes it may be really good wedge players will have, you know, a 9 or 10 or 11 degree lean to the shaft. Mm-hmm. And you look at DJ's bowed wrist and you just know that he's going to have that type of lag. He's going to have that. Mm-hmm. But how do you do that and not have the ball go to the right? You do that with body rotation.
Gotta go left.
And you gotta have that club rotate around your body to the left And DJ's a terrific wedge player and does really well with that. And as long as you keep rotating, then that club can stay on playing.
Yeah. Can you dive in a little bit to your work ethic? I've seen you practice. Other people have seen you practice. You know, you've been known as one of the hardest workers in the game. Talk a little bit about that and kind of what you were doing during your prime.
Well, I was never blessed with, you know, the physical attributes that a lot of my peers had. I wasn't as good an athlete. I didn't have long arms. I didn't have long legs. I'm not 6'3". I'm pretty strong, but you know, the lack of length to my levers, doesn't allow me to hit the ball with the ease that a lot of other guys do. I think when you look at the most attractive swings throughout the history of the world, they're usually tall, thin, long guys, mm-hmm. Or girls. And when you see somebody with long arms, long legs, and their body moves well, it looks pretty, even though it may not be any better than one that's not as attractive. And I never had that. My arms are short, my legs are short, and so I had to try to make up for that by working. And I felt like that if I worked on, paid attention to all aspects of the game, that I could compete.
Thomas, there's someone on tour right now who reminds you of yourself, a younger version of yourself, be it work ethic or style of play or really anything?
Well, the game has changed so much right now. It's really, it's hard to compare this generation or the guys that are out there now to what was before. The game is so wrapped around distance right now. Mm. More so than it's ever been. There's not a premium on driving it straight, as we saw in the Ryder Cup. The American players are not used to driving the ball straight, and when they get on a golf course where they have to drive it straight, they're not very effective. But that's, the way the golf courses are set up and the way the guys play, and it's what the tournament sponsors want to see, so I guess that's the way it is. But, in terms of work ethic, these guys all work hard. Whether they're in the gym or on the practice tee or, yesterday afternoon I was out there watching them, and golly, there must have been, out of the 64 guys in the field, it looked like 30 of them were on the putting green.
Really?
Working on their putting. The competition is so great right now that you have to do that. In my day, it was kind of the exception. I mean, there were a few guys that worked hard, but it was kind of the exception. But now, as with every generation, you learn from the guys that went before you. And, I would like to think that some of these guys are applying some of the techniques that I used, mm-hmm. 40 years or 30 years after I initiated them. When I first put the 60-degree wedge into my game, I was the very first one to do that. Now, everybody carries a 60-degree.
And a 63
or 64. Yeah.
And it tries to hit it from everywhere, right?
And they use it very effectively. Yeah. And I was always a good wedge player, but I'm amazed at how good these guys are. And there's so many of them. But they should be better. I mean, they should take what I did and what other players have done and build on it.
Yeah.
It's obvious in the workout, you look at the guys now copying what Tiger did. Mm-hmm. Well, Tiger wasn't the first one to do that.
No.
Greg Norman was before him. I was before Greg Norman. Gary Player was before me. Frank Stranahan was before them. So it's like, mm-hmm. But now I won't say everybody out of the 64 guys in this tournament are spend a lot of time in the gym, but a huge majority of them are. So these guys all work hard.
So you've been known to work hard in the gym. What year did you kind of adopt that and give us the progressions through when you started working on your body?
Well, I kind of, when I first went on tour, When I graduated from the University of Texas, you look at old pictures of me. I was a porker. I was fat and out of shape and not very strong. Didn't really work out. Spent too much time in the all you can eat buffet lines, you know, in Austin. And you know, those pictures are not very good. But my first year out on tour, you know, I dropped a lot of weight, dropped a lot of fat, just spending time on the golf course instead of in the restaurants. But I still wasn't very strong. And, you know, I went through probably 10 years of gradually trying to build my body up. But in the early 80s, probably 81 or 82, was when the Tour Fitness van first came out on the PGA Tour. And there were a couple of guys in there that, you know, our first trainers that we had out there encouraged a lot of us to come in and join it and start working out. And that's when the working out bug jumped on me. And so, you know, by 19, certainly by 82, I was on board with 100% and have continued to work out to this day.
That's awesome.
So Tom, obviously friends and family are important to you. And of course today is Tinley's funeral.
Yeah. Tinsley was just, you know, he carried on the legacy that his dad created here at the Austin Country Club. You know, this golf club was founded in 1899, and we didn't have a golf professional for a long time. And, you know, Harvey became the first golf professional at the Austin Country Club and was here as head pro or head pro emeritus until he passed away. And Tinsley was our second professional. He came in and was here for 20 or 25 years, and now we're on number three with Dale Morgan. So you think about a club that's over 120 years old or approaching 120 years, and we're on our third professional.
Amazing.
We got a great legacy here. If you sign on to be the head professional at the Austin Country Club, you plan on being here a long time.
Really?
That's really cool.
Wow.
That's really cool.
And you have grandkids. I understand you're very proud of.
Yeah, I've got four grandkids, three children. My son has two adopted daughters, and my daughter has two kids, and then my other son's not married yet, so proud family. Yeah, it's a good family.
That's wonderful.
So before we end it with the rapid-fire questions, can you give us, I worked with Chuck Cook for years and years, mm-hmm. and clearly got the privilege of watching you work. Give us a Chuck Cook story, or kind of just what Chuck Cook is about as an instructor.
Well, I think, you know, Chuck makes learning fun. He is unbelievably intelligent, and he's got a very sharp wit. And, you know, you never have to worry about getting too cocky when you take a lesson from Chuck, because he can always humble you with his biting wit, as I'm sure y'all found out when you talked to him the other day. But, you know, Chuck's been a good friend for a long time, and you know, we've gone through a learning process together, you know, because, you know, a lot of what Chuck believes now in his teaching philosophy and you know what he tries to incorporate, a lot of that was acquired when I was trying to learn about my golf swing and trying to improve my swing and you know Chuck is I think he's, you know, as I jokingly talk with a lot of other teachers, there's only 10 in the top 10 and Chuck's one of those. So you know, there's not many that are the caliber that Chuck is. But, you know, I can remember one time I was taking a lesson from Harvey, and Chuck was out there watching as I was getting a lesson from Harvey. And, you know, Chuck tells the story that after that lesson, Chuck went up to him. He said, "Harvey, how did you know to tell Tom what to do?" He said, I wouldn't have thought about going about it that way. And Harvey said, "Well, Chuck, when I was your age, I didn't know it either."
You know, so, a little dig.
I mean, we're all trying to learn, and you know, Chuck is in his 70s now, and he's just like Harvey was. He's still trying to learn and trying to get better.
Yeah.
Well, this is funny time. So I grew up in a in Waterbury, Connecticut, a Donald Ross course, and I was a short kid, not very athletic, mm-hmm. and I had big, thick glasses. Mm-hmm. You were my hero.
Boy,
I'm not kidding.
Well, that, you know.
It was funny.
I'm a very unlikely hero for anybody.
Well, really, it was funny at the time. We're thinking, of course, I was caddying, and you know, every kid tries to compare themselves to a golfer. And I said, yeah. Tom Kite, look at, he's got glasses like me.
Right.
Look at, he's dominating. And so, you know, I was a little upset when he got the LASIK surgery
and
started looking really handsome.
Not upset. believe me, I'd been wanting to have corrective surgery for my eyes for years and years and years. Unfortunately, that my eyes were so poor that the RK and the BRK mm-hmm. would have created all sorts of issues. Mm-hmm. With being able to see, especially at night vision, right. with the starburst and everything. So my doctors, you know, they correctly shied me away from mm-hmm. that and just said, you can't do that yet. You're going to have to wait until something new comes out. And then when the LASIK came out in the late 1990s, I was the first guy on tour to have the LASIK surgery. And you know, immediately, my vision just got way better. I was 20/20 with my glasses, but as anybody who wears thick glasses knows, you get some distortion.
Yeah.
You perceive what you're seeing as real, but there is definitely some distortion. And certainly, dealing with glasses in a rainstorm or on a high humidity, mm-hmm. foggy day, you know, those are things that. You just don't want to have to go through. And I look at the guys right now that are playing. Every one of them on the driving range right now has 20/20 vision or better,
mm-hmm. yeah.
Because of the advancement. And to be able to play your entire career, and especially in your prime, knowing that what you're looking at is exactly what is.
That's a big deal.
Is a huge advantage. So these guys, again, you know, not that I was a pioneer in this thing, but, to be able to correct your vision and show that it can still have benefits and certainly advantageous when you get on the golf course.
Yeah, I'll never forget. I had it, too, probably 15 years ago. It was amazing how the blades of grass on the green looked different, didn't they?
Yeah.
It was like 3D. It was like sharp. I couldn't believe it.
Totally sharp. I mean, you correct a 20/20, but... that's in a doctor's office with the lights out and a white screen and black letters.
Right.
You know, that's 20/20. But, when you get out in the field and you start looking at flowers and trees and leaves and branches and start trying to read grain, you know, that's way away from 20/20 vision until you have that corrective surgery. So I'm a huge believer in it.
Okay, so here we go. We're going to go close this out with the emergency nine with Tom Kite. Are you ready, Tom?
No.
Okay, here we go.
No, I'm not.
Here we go.
Okay.
Who will win the WGC match play this week?
John Rahm.
Oh, great. That's quick. All right. How about this? Best ball striker you've ever seen?
Lee Trevino.
Best short game that you've ever seen?
Crenshaw. Seve.
Or you?
Seve.
Seve.
Seve. Nice.
Yeah. Will Tiger get to Jack's record?
I want him to, but I don't think so.
Most thorough or best putter you've seen?
Ben Crenshaw.
Who was your best friend during your prime on tour?
Jim Simons.
Given that you've actually enjoyed this show, what three figures in golf should we have on?
Well, if you can work it around, I would try to get Walter Hagen. I would try to get Ben Hogan. And let me see.
Sam Snead.
I'd go for Harvey Pienick. I think he'd be a great interview.
Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah. Well, thanks.
Let me know how that works out.
Thanks again for the time, Tom. It's always a pleasure being around you, and you're a great ambassador for the game.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate it. Nice to be with you guys.
Great. All right, you've been listening to Golf Underground on ESPN Radio.
The chemical. I'm breaking in.